I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. We start today by going deeper into the new rulings and gag order in the Freddie Gray trials with a UB law professor. What do they mean for the trial schedule to start in 6 weeks? Then we turn to the Democrats' presidential debate with two political experts and your thoughts. The five candidates' two-hour showdown in Las Vegas was lively and substantive. It gave Martin O'Malley his first moment on stage with frontrunners Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Did it change the political landscape? How does it compare with GOP debates? All that on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you tuned in. In a few minutes, we'll welcome two political experts to talk about last night's Democratic presidential debate, and we really hope to talk with you about the debate. Did it change your thinking about the lineup? Did it bring any issues into sharper focus or lead you to think differently about any of the candidates? We have our phone lines open now. Call us at 410-662-8780 or toll-free at 866-661-9309. Tell us what you think, or you can also send us an email, midday@wypr.org. But first, we welcome University of Baltimore Law Associate Professor David Jaros back to our studio. Welcome back to the show. He is professor of criminal law, procedure, and evidence, and we want to talk to him about the Freddie Gray case. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about yesterday's rulings by Baltimore Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams, these cases against the six city police officers stemming from the death of Freddie Gray last April. Judge Williams imposed a gag order at the end of the day on the defense attorneys and the prosecutors. But I want to talk first about his decision before that to deny two motions filed by officers attempting to quash statements they made to investigators after Gray's death. Same issues for these two officers, Sergeant Alicia White and Officer William Porter?
The legal issues are the same. Both officers were making an argument that the statements were made and were taken in violation of their constitutional right to remain silent, and therefore were asking the court to suppress them and bar them from being used in the trials.
And I gather that part of the argument was that they didn't know when they started talking that they were suspects.
So that was a little tricky part of the case. The defense attorneys tried to make some hay out of the fact that particularly Officer White, Alicia White, was under the impression that she was being treated as a witness, not as a suspect, the first time she spoke to the officers. And they say that she was, in fact, a suspect even at that point. Unfortunately for them, that's not really the critical legal issue. The critical legal issue is whether or not she really felt coerced into making those statements and couldn't invoke her right to remain silent. When you feel that you can end a conversation or leave an interview, it's no longer a custodial interrogation, and therefore, under Miranda, you no longer have an issue if you choose to speak.
Okay, so her lawyers on her behalf are arguing that she did feel coerced.
They did try to make that argument. And probably the strongest argument they had is there's a wrinkle in this case, which is the witnesses are officers. And therefore, when they are ordered to speak, they have a tension between their need to do what they're obligated to do to keep their job and their right to remain silent. And the Supreme Court has said in a case called Garrity versus New Jersey that the police can't order an officer to testify to make statements and waive their constitutional rights. But here the judge didn't accept that she was, in fact, ordered to make statements.
Well, I'm a little unclear on how, if her attorney speaking for her says she felt coerced, I mean, she's the expert on what she felt. How does the judge get around that?
The defense attorney, of course, has the opportunity, if he wants to, he could put his client on the stand and she could offer her own views of the interview. That's not necessarily a strategic thing that the defense attorneys want to do, because they may not want to expose their client to cross-examination at this point
in
the trial.
And they did not.
They did not
put
her on the stand. But the issue in the end is an objective question, not a subjective question. So legally, the question is, objectively, was this a custodial interrogation? And in this case, there's no question that the judge found that this was a voluntary statement, that it was not coerced. And in fact, the fact that she was being treated by as a witness seems to suggest in some ways that the defense has a weaker argument. Because if she's a witness, she's less likely to feel that she is being forced to be there, that she has no right to leave. The judge drew attention to the fact that the door wasn't locked when she was interviewed. Even the second time, she was allowed to keep her gun on her. She was not treated like someone who's sort of being told, you had better talk.
That is University of Baltimore law professor, associate professor David Jaros. He'll be with us for 10 minutes or so. And if you have a question for him about the Freddie Gray case, you can call us 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. What significance does the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights have? You mentioned the Miranda rulings, the federal case law that applies to in all criminal cases, at least.
Right. So,
but what about their particular protections under the state law enforcement?
Precisely because of this concern that officers will be torn between their desire to keep their job and their right to remain silent, that gave rise to, across the country, states passing laws that are law enforcement officers' Bill of Rights, which give them actually a greater degree of protection than any other defendant when the police want to investigate whether they committed a crime and want to ask them questions and take statements. Here, the court found that there was no violation of the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights. Officers were read their rights. They initialed that they understood what they were waiving, and they signed at the bottom. So at the end of the day, there was no violation of either the statute or of the sort of larger constitutional rights under Miranda.
But again, they did that sort of after they'd already spoken. Correct, or at least in Sergeant White's case.
In Sergeant White's case, the actual signing of the law officer, as I understand it, the signing of the rights and the reading of them came during her second interview. But I think that was because initially she was not being investigated; she was being treated like a witness. And it seems that, and it is not a problem if at some point during the course of the investigation, the officers looking into this issue decided that actually she might be guilty of a crime. They shift gears and then they tell her, now you're being investigated. You have these rights. You have the right to an attorney. You have the right to breaks. You have a right to have your commanding officer, I think, there during the interview. There are a variety of rights that you're entitled to as an officer when you're being questioned about a crime that you're not entitled to if you're an ordinary citizen.
I realize as you're explaining this and making it clearer to me, it suddenly clicked that I've been approaching this like sort of like a reporter, thinking of interviewees who say, "Oh, I didn't realize I was on the record." That's what I've been thinking of it, as if you have to tell somebody prospectively that you're on the record. It's not quite the same.
It's not quite the same. It's really the question is whether or not you're coerced into making a statement when you have a right to remain silent. In fact, the Supreme Court has allowed some pretty tricky behavior by police officers when they question suspects. And in fact, ironically, these officers were probably trained in how to establish trust with a suspect and how to get them talking. There are all kinds of ways in which in everyday interviews with suspects in an attempt to get them to confess, police officers do a variety of things to convince them that either there's a famous case where the officers suggested that the victim was in fact still alive when they knew for a while that she had died and it was going to be a murder case. But they pretended to take a phone call in the middle of the interview and learn that she had just passed away, and see how that had an effect on the suspect.
So, I mean, I'm sorry. Is your point that Sergeant White
and Officer Porter probably knew these techniques that were being that might have been being used on them?
Well, I think there's two things. One is that the tricking of a suspect into thinking that they are not a serious suspect, that they are being treated more like a witness, or that the officer is their friend. Those things have been endorsed by the Supreme Court as not a violation of rights. A secondary question is that we should. You know, when the officers sort of tried to claim that they had no idea what was going on, they didn't realize they had a right to remain silent, not only were those rights at least read in the subsequent interview, but they're trained in how to do these types of interrogations.
Ernest from West Baltimore is calling with a question. Welcome to the show, Ernest.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The officers have a real problem. Because when they went into that room, first of all, they wasn't under arrest. But when they turned that recorder on, all they had to do was say, I would like to call the FOP lawyer, and I would like to have him present. And they would have to stop asking them any kind of questions at all. And the other problem that they have is with
Ernest, before you move on, I just want to double-check that with David Jarosz. Is that the case?
That is essentially right. I mean, there was a phone call with Officer Porter. So Officer Porter in the first statement was not even in a room with the investigator. And the question was, the investigator said something along the lines of, I really need to know what happened. And what the defense attorneys tried to argue was that the officer was being ordered to speak. Mm. And if he was being ordered to speak, then arguably he was being ordered to waive his right to remain silent. Judge didn't buy that found that this was merely a question to say, can you tell me what happened?
Hmm. Ernest, your other point.
My other point is for the cruising patrol, the prisoner transport officer. If he had called the ambulance right to the scene when the prisoner said, I can't breathe, he would have been out of the loop. And the other thing, if he hadn't called the ambulance to the scene, if he had taken the prisoner right to a hospital, from that location to a hospital, then everything would have been, he would have been out of the loop. But by him saying that I had to make stops and all this, particularly when each district has two cruising patrols, and if your cruising patrol, if you're out of service with a prisoner that's in a serious state, your obligation is to take care of that, not drive around the district handling other calls. Because even if both cruising patrols are out in your district, they will send another cruising patrol from another district to handle any other problems that you have.
I hear what you're saying, Ernest. We're focusing right now just on the motions that were before the judge yesterday, and I believe Officer Goodson was somebody who has not made statements to the police. So.
Officer Goodson hasn't made a statement, but Ernest raises a point, which is, you know, the prosecution's argument here is that it seems to be their theory of the case that the officers were on notice that the victim needed medical attention and they were negligent or even reckless in failing to get it. What comes up as a legal matter related to these statements is that there remains very much a question about how these statements can ultimately be used. So I think it's important to recognize that the judge's decision to allow these statements to come in is really a decision just to say these statements weren't taken in violation of constitutional rights and therefore aren't suppressed at this moment. But the state still has to come up with their theory of how they get them in. And most importantly, while Officer Porter's statement are very likely admissible against Officer Porter, it's very hard to imagine how the state is actually going to be able to get that statement in against any of the other defendants.
Why is that hard?
Well, an out-of-court statement made by one person is hearsay. Made by anyone, an out-of-court statement offered for its truth is hearsay. And typically, we don't allow hearsay to come in. We say you have a right to confront your witnesses, and you have to call the witness to come in and testify about what happened in court. And what makes that even more difficult is you have a Sixth Amendment constitutional right to confront cases, to confront witnesses. And so in a case called Crawford v. Washington, the court said when the police go out to investigate a crime and someone makes a statement to the police can't then just bring that statement and offer it into evidence. You have to call that witness to come in and testify. What that suggests is when Officer White is on trial, the state will need Officer Porter to come in and testify about what happened. They can't just read his statement into the record.
Okay. And that's not obvious that Officer Porter
will
would
do
testify.
That. I think the state's theory could be one of two things. One, that they hope, I think they certainly hope, that they will convict Officer Porter, and then Officer Porter will have an incentive to cooperate with them and to testify against his fellow officers. Alternatively, they could try to make the argument that whether or not he's convicted or acquitted, he no longer faces criminal prosecution for this issue, and therefore he doesn't have a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent because he's not exposing himself to a conviction. But I think that's hard to make because I think that he can still be charged with a federal crime, and therefore he could still justifiably invoke his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent.
So the takeaway then is that when we heard yesterday the statements can be admitted in the courtroom, it's very limited.
It's really not they can be admitted in the courtroom. It's rather that they shouldn't be suppressed because they violated the defendant's constitutional rights when they were taken. The question of whether or not they are admissible in any one case is a very different question. It's hard to imagine a situation where the state couldn't bring Officer Porter's statement in against himself because your own statements can be used against you. It doesn't matter if you made them out of court. But bringing in an out-of-court statement and offering it against another criminal defendant is very hard to do.
Very, very quickly before we leave for a break, the judge's gag order sounded pretty sweeping. Do not discuss my rulings. Do not discuss this case. Is this the new normal for all of these cases? Do you expect this gag order to be with us as this whole set of trials unfolds?
I think what's motivating the judge here is a desire to keep the jury pool as clear as possible, as clean as possible, and so that they can pick a jury that hasn't already predetermined how they feel about this case and isn't aware of evidence that is not going to be admissible at trial but they've heard about through the media. And I think that's the reason for the gag order. I think we're going to learn a lot from jury selection in the first trial. First, about whether or not this case can be tried here in Baltimore. And second, about sort of how is it going to be when we try and pick the next jury. But at each stage in this process, more and more information is going to be exposed to the jury pool. So once we finish, we've been talking for a while about venue and about whether this case would be tried here in Baltimore. And the judge has said at this point, look, we're going to pick a jury here in Baltimore, and we're going to see if that jury can be fair. But the harder question is, once we have one trial here in Baltimore and all the press around that trial, well, we have a whole new venue issue now because there's been a new set of incidents that have arisen from that trial, and we'll have to do this all over again.
And we'll ask you back to talk about it.
I hope so.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Associate Law Professor Professor David Jaros from the University of Baltimore. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll switch gears, talk about last night's Democratic debates, presidential debates in Las Vegas. We'll have Matthew Krenson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, and Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland. And we're looking forward to your thoughts. Our phone lines are open. Call us, 410-662-8780, or toll free at 1-866-661-9309. And tell us what you think, or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. So now we're going to focus on last night's Democratic debate in Las Vegas. What were some of the highlights of the two-hour event at the Wynn Las Vegas? Who won? Who lost ground? How did former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley fare as he attempted to defend his controversial crime-fighting record when he was mayor of Baltimore? Tough questioning by CNN's Anderson Cooper. Some of the questions that we will ask our experts, Matthew Krenson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Sheila.
Headlines. What is your takeaway, Matthew?
I think the what I saw in this debate was something that nobody mentioned, or at least not until the very end. It was civil. The participants disagreed with one another on a lot of things, but there were no personal insults. In fact, there were no personal insults of people who, you know, in the population, of immigrants, African Americans. This looked like the party that was capable of governing, and nobody bothered to draw the contrast between this debate and the others that we've seen.
Let me differ with you a bit. That was kind of a main point of Martin O'Malley's closing statement.
Yeah, right. I think Hillary Clinton should have made the same point more starkly. It was one that impressed me. It also impressed people in Washington at the Brookings Institution, for example. They said the big loser in this debate was the Republican Party.
Huh. Interesting. What's your takeaway, Barry? I'd
agree with Matt that this was a discussion to a large extent about policy. It wasn't about who can shout the loudest, who can get the angriest and get the audience revved up the most. It was not a debate designed to draw huge ratings. It was more of a wonkish type of discussion. And I think going into the evening, Hillary Clinton was the big dog in this fight. And at the end of the evening, she was an even bigger dog. That Bernie Sanders is a passionate, energetic preacher. It's not someone that you can imagine could take on the complexities of the job of president, but he is someone that you might go to a church revival to hear, because you're going to come away feeling, yeah, that's right, that's right. I think the last time I was on the show, I mentioned the similarities between the primary campaign now and the movie from 1976, Network, in which the main character is a TV commentator who gets carried away and decides he's just going to tell the truth on the air and start shouting, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And that's what you're hearing from a lot of the Republican contenders. And so far, it's driving their debate. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders is a lot like that. You can tell he's angry. He's passionate about what he says. However, after hearing him for 2 hours, what you come away with is that it is a bit of a one-note type of campaign.
Well, I sound more contrarian, I think, than I feel, but I almost had the opposite reaction to Bernie Sanders last night, in the sense that, I mean, actually, the grumpy old man on stage was Jim Webb, because he just wasn't getting the airtime that he thought he deserved. And indeed, the numbers sort of bear it out. He ranked fourth in the amount of airtime that FaceTime that he got. But certainly there were moments of curmudgeonly rhetoric from Bernie Sanders, but also the moment that everyone's pointing to as the moment of great comedy, the moment of the handshake, when Bernie Sanders came to Hillary Clinton's defense on emails, and everybody in that hall, the Democrats in that hall, wanted to love that.
Not only that, but his reaching out to Jim Webb and expressing his respect for Webb and their work together to improve the lot of veterans. He had a generosity of spirit there that you don't find in Donald Trump.
And generosity of spirit is not necessarily what I was expecting to walk away from. And I wish our listeners could see your face, Barry. You look completely unconvinced by anything I've said in the last minute.
I think that Hillary Clinton wanted to make the point that if you want someone who can be president, can manage the presidential office, can go up against Putin, can take a nuanced position on highly complex issues, who can try to actually find a way to find areas of agreement with the hardcore conservative Congress, that she's got the tools and the experience to do it. You didn't hear that from Sanders. What you heard was he was mad as heck about the way things are, and he was going to change it with radical socialist type solutions, that we're going to have a Denmark-style healthcare system. And there's very little meat on the bone, so to speak, beyond this broad outline from him as to how he's going to do it. It's more, as I said, preaching than it is being realistic and pragmatic. I just found it interesting that Clinton's whole approach was to try to say, look, I'm ready to be president. I know the details. I know how difficult and complicated this can be. I'm the person to do it.
And early on, she made the point. She said, "I'm a progressive who likes results. To get things done."
Yeah.
She sort of established that. And there in the hall, they were willing to accept that.
And then the charges that she always changes her position, things like that. She didn't come back as effectively as she could there. But she might have pointed out that this is what politicians have to do. It's called compromise. You have to go halfway to meet your opponents. And the likelihood is that the next president is going to have a Republican Congress. It's just the way things are. Somebody has to be in the White House who can deal with those people. And I think she's probably more likely prepared for that by her own experience than anybody else up on that stage.
Well, that's certainly what she was trying to project last night. That's Matthew Krenson. Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland. Barry, you mentioned, and you can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Barry, you mentioned Denmark. I want to play part of what of the way Hillary Clinton responded when Bernie Sanders said he was going to teach people what democratic socialism means. I mean, he sort of envisions this as a seminar, I think. And she stepped in and had something to say to that.
I don't think we should confuse what we have to do every so often in America, which is save capitalism from itself. And I think what Senator Sanders is saying certainly makes sense in the terms of the inequality that we have. But we are not Denmark. I love Denmark. We are the United States of America, and it's our job to rein in the excesses of capitalism so that it doesn't run amok and doesn't cause the kind of inequities that we're seeing in our economic system. But we would be making a grave mistake to turn our backs on what built the greatest middle class in the history
Senator
of the
Sanders?
World.
Were either of you surprised that capitalism needed to be defended?
Not with Bernie Sanders on the platform, because it was certain that he was going to bring it up. I thought that was probably pretty close to the high point of Clinton's performance last night.
Really? Why?
Yeah. Because she reached out, while criticizing Wall Street and bankers, she reached out to the more moderate members of her party in a way that Sanders can't do. For example, she also talked about the importance of small business enterprise. That's a constituency that she could appeal to, and their employees. I think she was more open in her presentation than Sanders. Sanders was preaching to the choir, in a sense.
And Sanders had this other problem, which had to do with guns.
Yeah.
That he finds it very difficult to rationalize his votes in the Congress that it can be explained back home in rural Vermont. But when you get into more populous, urbanized type of communities, the gun control issue is totally different, especially with the tragedies we've had in recent years. And his explanations were lame. Martin O'Malley jumped on him a number of times.
Let's take a minute to listen to that. That was one of O'Malley's most energetic moments, I think.
Senator, excuse me. Senator, it was not about rural. Senator, it was not about rural and urban.
Exactly about
Have you ever been to the Eastern Shore? Have you ever been to Western Maryland? We were able to pass this and still respect the hunting traditions of people who live in our rural areas. And we did it, Anderson, by leading with principle, not by pandering to the NRA and backing down to the NRA.
Not by pandering to the NRA. And this was, I guess, after, or maybe it was before, I've forgotten the sequence now, Hillary Clinton also took Sanders on in a very clear way,
saying he
had not been at all tough enough.
Right, and that got one of the larger applauses from the audience of the evening. Hillary Clinton was the one who really kept coming back to that we have to fight the National Rifle Association. But more than that, she kept repeating, we have to remember we've got to run against the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. That's really what this election is about. Sanders, on the other hand, is still into, we have to do something about tearing down Wall Street the way it exists today and, going after billionaires. And, after a while, by the end of the 2 hours, I was beginning to feel kind of sorry for the billionaires because they're getting beaten up so badly.
But I did have the impression that Secretary Clinton was pleased to be able to get to the left of Bernie Sanders on an issue like gun control. I can't think of another issue that came up last night where she could do that.
I can't think of any either. I think that was the sole issue where she came out appealing more effectively to the liberal Democrats than he did.
Right. Now, Sanders talked about free education for college students, health care for all, and stuff like that. And it was interesting. Nobody really called him on. Jim Webb did, but only briefly. How are you going to pay for this, Bernie? The numbers here are staggering, absolutely staggering for what he wants to do. But he got away with that pretty much. And, he's a very good rhetorical speaker, Sanders is. And he appeals
to
people.
He's a good debater. He's very good at taking a question and shifting it slightly to what he wants to talk about.
Right. And he's got these set lines that he's used forever. Even in the Senate, he used them apparently over and over and over again. And
give me an example of the set lines.
Well, the whole thing on Wall Street and
the billionaires,
billionaires and so forth. I've talked to some people on the Hill that say, Bernie has always been like a broken record. He's got certain causes. He's a crusader. Yeah. I think that's what we saw last night, and it plays very well on TV and before large audiences.
The line I think he used was "Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street; Wall Street regulates Congress."
That was a great one. Yeah,
it's a great one, but it's something he repeats over and over again. I think we have a long way to go till the election. People are going to get tired of hearing those same lines over and over again. And also, I think people have a limited tolerance for being shouted at. And I think that's
Of course, that's always one of the things that's hard to remember when you get engaged. And I found this an engaging 2.5 hours. I think probably a lot of people who tuned in did. And we forget how many people did not tune in.
Right.
It's not yet front and center for most Americans, even Americans who expect to vote.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point, which is I still consider this part of the silly season of politics, presidential politics, that it seems like every time we have warm weather, you have people expressing their upsets, their anger in political campaigns. And by the time you get to the actual voting, say in Iowa, where it's liable to be below 32 degrees, people start to look more seriously at their politicians. So I think, as you said, there's a long way to go yet. Mm-hmm. One of the stunning facts is that we're 14 months away from really voting for president of the United States. 14 months of this? I don't know if the public can take it. They might get bored.
And that's an important point, boredom. because Sanders' strategy for winning is increasing turnout. countries.
Right. He spoke to that. Yeah.
But people in the United States seem to be so disgusted with politics as it stands that I'm not sure that's a feasible strategy. I don't know how many people are going to turn out for the presidential election. And all indications are that they're disenchanted.
Well, that's probably a good point for us to pause and think about all this. We're going to take a short break. We'd love to get your input. You can call us at 410-662-8780 to tell us what you thought about the Democratic presidential debate last night in Las Vegas. Toll free, that's 866-661-9309, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Look forward to talking with you. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. On today's show, we're talking with Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland and Matthew Krensen, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Johns Hopkins, about last night's presidential Democratic debate in Las Vegas. And we'd like you to be part of the conversation, too. You can call us at 410-662-8780. Or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. The consensus that I've picked up from the analysis I've had time to read and hear this morning seems to be that Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland, did well, but not enough to really change the landscape. And before I let you guys tell me whether you agree with that, let's listen to how O'Malley responded when Anderson Cooper, early on, Anderson Cooper of CNN, grilled him about his policing policies when he was mayor of Baltimore.
One of the things that was not reported during that heartbreaking night of unrest in Baltimore was that arrests had actually fallen to a 38-year low in the year prior to Freddie Gray's tragic death. Anderson, when I ran for mayor of Baltimore back in 1999, it was not because our city was doing well. It was because we had allowed ourselves to become the most violent, addicted, and abandoned city in America. And I ran and promised people that together we could turn that around. And we put our city on a path to reduce violent crime, or part one crime, by more than any major city in America over the next 10 years. We've saved over 1,000 lives in Baltimore in the last 15 years of people working together. And the vast majority of them were young and poor and black. It wasn't easy on any day. But we saved lives and we gave our city a better future, improving police and community relations every single day that I was in office.
In one year,
that was Martin O'Malley defending his policing policies when he was mayor. So what did you think of that particular defense of his policies? And overall, how would you assess how Martin O'Malley did last night?
I thought it sounded a little different this morning than it did last night, but I thought he looked defensive.
He looked
defensive and a little abashed in his response.
At that moment or throughout?
At that moment. I think that he felt wounded at that moment. And I think it probably hurt him a little. The other thing that hurt him was when he criticized Hillary Clinton for voting in favor of the making war in Iraq. And then she turned around said,
"Let's hear this.
Okay,
we have this clip, and it's short. I'd like to hear how she responded to that."
I have to say, I was very pleased when Governor O'Malley endorsed me for president in 2008, and I enjoyed his strong support in that campaign. And I consider him obviously a friend.
We can't share the expression on her face, but even the tone of her voice. Barry Raskovar, what was she communicating to him, or what was she communicating to voters, do you think, with that reflection on his 2008 endorsement?
I think if she could have said it in private, it would have been, "You hypocrite." It's politics. What can you say? And one day you're supporting someone, and a few years later, you're on the other side. And then suddenly you're looking at all the chinks in the armor, while previously you were looking at all the successes. I think this is par for the course in politics. It's one of the things, though, that voters don't like. And one of the charges against Hillary Clinton has been, well, she's inconsistent. Well, the world is inconsistent. We're all inconsistent. I like to remind people when I give talks that politicians have feet of clay, every one of them. They're all imperfect human beings. But as voters, we want that hero to be riding in on a white horse. And it just doesn't happen. Now, right now, Bernie Sanders, because he is so eloquent and so emotionally captivating, is the person who is drawing all the attention. But the person who is more of the policy wonk that is giving more practical answers is Hillary Clinton. So you know, Democrats are, as Matt pointed out in the beginning, Democrats are having a much calmer discussion about this so that Hillary Clinton's voice can be heard. On the other side, the Republican side, the person who was the supposed front runner, Jeb Bush, his voice can't be heard at all because of all the shouting that's going on from the horde of candidates, from Donald Trump down, who are just drowning out discussions of policy.
Yeah, Jeb Bush would probably do better as a Democrat.
I wonder how he'd react to hearing that. We have some callers who were quite interested in what you all said about Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. Jason in Charles Village. Jason, welcome to Midday.
Thanks, Sheila. Hi. I wasn't with the show at the very beginning, but when I joined in, there was some criticism of Bernie Sanders regarding Hillary's gun control criticism of him. And then there was something about how his agenda is just so far out there that he'd never explain how he was going to do it. I don't think that's fair, and I think he clearly did explain in both cases. He talked about gun control, about how you can scream about how we've got gun control and all that, but you've really got to bring people together, otherwise nothing's ever going to happen. And so that's where he was saying about Hillary. She's just saying things that sound great, but it's never going to get done. And then he went through discussing mental health and background checks and things where he might be able to work with the NRA and also Republicans. And then the other thing about his agenda in terms of Social Security, college tuition, those sorts of things, he clearly said that this is a movement that needs to bring in people who have to help him do it. And obviously they're not going to be able to do everything, but at least he's showing what he stands for and the people he wants to fight for. Whereas on Hillary's side, you don't really get that. There are a couple of instances, but I mean, I think he did explain those things and suggest that, you know, he didn't and that he has no answer for that. You may not buy it, but I thought it was a pretty compelling explanation.
Okay, Jason, fair point. I appreciate your calling. I want to move immediately to Patrick in Annapolis, who may have something similar to say. Patrick, thanks for calling.
Hi, yeah. I was just calling because you were suggesting that most voters are going to be disenfranchised with the process by the time we're voting for president. But I feel with Bernie's passion and sincerity, he's going to keep voters interested. Right now, he's getting most of his donations from individual donors with an average of about $30. I read today that after the debate last night, contributions were up to about $1.3 million. And I think with that kind of grassroots support, he's going to do well in the presidential race.
Patrick, thanks for calling. Let me take that to Matthew Crenson and Barry Raskovar. So did Bernie Sanders do himself better than you were giving him credit for a few minutes ago?
Well, I think overall this was not the best night for Bernie Sanders, but he did help himself. He will be able to raise more money. They'll get more volunteers. The big winner clearly was Hillary Clinton in this. As far as the other three, Martin O'Malley was the best of the rest. But will that help him in this race? I don't think it'll help him that much, but I think it does set the stage for another try for presidency in 4 or 8 years, when he will be better known. And, this makes him a rising star in the party.
His performance last night contributes to that.
When I say rising star, I mean in 4 or 8 years, uh-huh. But not this time. This is a test run.
Okay. O'Malley has been arguing for more debates, mm-hmm. more than the Democrats
six.
Have, what, six scheduled?
Six. Mm-hmm.
We're told that Hillary Clinton put a lot of time into rehearsing for last mm-hmm. night. Is there any reason that she and Sanders would agree to more than the scheduled debates?
I think not. I mean, this is really a contest between the two of them right now. And in response to the caller's comments, it's true. Sanders had done unexpectedly well so far with mobilizing people in the neighboring state of New Hampshire and in Iowa. The question is, can he sustain it for over a year? And that's where I think the questions come up.
So much of the media attention, especially from the major newspapers of this country, have been on Hillary Clinton. Her flaws, her weaknesses, she's not doing as well as expected. Her numbers are going down in the polls. And suddenly you have a performance like she had last night, which was really quite strong. And it may have surprised a lot of people, but I think once again it's very clear she's the clear front runner. I think it's going to take a lot to overcome the money and the internal support she has within the party apparatus, the support she has from feminists across the country. And it came through last night, even in the questioning. Everything was focused on her. She was in control of that debate.
Oh, I think so, too. Lorenzo is calling us from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday, Lorenzo.
Hey, how are you guys?
Fine. How are you?
Great. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the black vote. For the last, say, couple of months or so, maybe a few months, as all this email stuff has been going on and as Hillary has kind of been off, the beaten path, kind of off doing her thing, a lot of my friends and family, I'm African-American, but a lot of friends, family in my group have been like, I don't know, man, Hillary, and they've been liking what Bernie said. Everyone's been talking about Bernie sounds pretty darn good. I like that, and I don't know. I'm changing my mind about Hillary. I must have talked to, 10 or 11 family members and friends who had said the same thing. But last night, during a debate, we're Facebooking back and forth and texting. Everybody's at first saying, yeah, Bernie's pretty good. And then all of a sudden, everyone's going, oh, no, Hillary's the one. She's got it. Oh, yeah, she's it. And it's just like boom, boom, boom. Everybody's liking. So, obviously that's not scientific, and it's
no, but it's
poll.
Very interesting, yeah, Lorenzo. Yes. I appreciate your sharing it. Let me just ask, we're real tight on time, so just let me ask you quickly. There was a moment when I think Anderson Cooper asked both Sanders and O'Malley about do Black Lives Matter or do all lives matter? It struck me that they were showing that they had learned the lesson. How did it strike you, Lorenzo?
Yeah, I'm here. Yes. Well, that's kind of. It struck me that they did learn their lesson or whatever, and it shows that this Black Lives the movement there, they've got a little bit of power. But I don't really think it made a lot of. It made a lot of difference to a lot of young Black folk, but it didn't make a lot of difference to a lot of middle aged and older Black folk. I really don't think so.
Lorenzo, I really appreciate your calling. We're down to a minute, gentlemen. Closing thoughts about this debate, Matthew Cranston.
I agree with Barry that the best performance was Hillary Clinton's. And in commenting on the last caller, Lorenzo's remarks, going into this debate, the Clintons collectively had the monopoly of African-American support. And it's interesting to see that she's already come out of this debate and seems to have still the African-American vote behind her.
Yeah, and the whole Black Lives Matter question is one of these nuanced issues that if you don't handle it well, it could blow up in your face. Black Lives Matter in a Democratic primary, very much that theme. However, when you get to a general election, then it's all lives matter is the theme. So you somehow have to finesse this. And I thought Hillary Clinton was the best at doing this, although O'Malley, I think, had definitely learned a lesson from his prior mistake.
We have to leave it at that. I'm really grateful to you both, Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland, Matthew Cranston, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Johns Hopkins. And to our listeners, thank you for this conversation. I'm Sheila Cast. Lunch for our midday guests provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36 in Hampton. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiche. Stay tuned after the news for Here and Now on WIPR 88.1. I'm Sheila Klass. Glad you've been with us.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Dronberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.